Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I'm your host, Christopher Hart. This week we sat down with, we had a little bit of a surprise guest, but we sat down with Brendan McLaren, head of maturing whiskey stocks at Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. If you have any experience in whiskey, you've heard of Glenmorangie. And I was surprised to find out last minute that we were also being greeted by David Blackmore, the global brand ambassador for Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. He is, he's been living in Dallas the last couple of years. I didn't know this until this episode, but I didn't realize he was so close or we would do more together. But he and Brendan are the, they've been preaching the good word of finished single malt scotch for several years now. And if you know anything about sherry finishes or PX, you know, just any of the typical barrel finishes that you expect with scotch, Glenmorangie's done it all. And we got to sit down and talk about it. It was an absolute, it was fun. I say that every week. This was a fun episode. This was a blast. It's got to become numb at some point, but it was everything I hoped for in an episode, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We actually ran a little long. Typically, we try to keep this to an hour, and we went over. We went an hour and 15, probably an hour and 20, including this introduction. So it was everything I wanted. We got some questions asked and answered. Paul Hansen, I know you're listening. You had proposed a question a while back and to Bill Lumsden, who Brendan is the second in line to taking over as master distiller, master blender for both brands, right behind Bill Lumsden, who is a character himself. And if you want to talk about a character, Brendan is a character. So it was a very good time. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So this week's episode, like every episode, is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Woodford Reserve is one of the most iconic brands in bourbon, and they are big supporters of the show, and I couldn't be happier with it. So without further ado, Brendan McLaren and David Blackmore with Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. Thank you, guys. Cheers. Being here, I wasn't expecting pleasure. You. I, yeah. What was the change?
I've been missing Brendan. So
yeah. Did you guys run into each other, kind of cross paths in Dallas, or was this a?
This was just a nice surprise.
Yeah. I got in from Maryland.
Okay,
so that's me saying it in the American way. We would say Maryland because there's an R in it. But I got in from Maryland, and you got in this morning, didn't you?
Yeah, I just came down.
So we just met up in the hotel this morning.
Okay.
Rekindled our passion, our romance, and then came here. We almost didn't show up.
Do you guys have an HR department?
We do, but this isn't getting recorded.
No one's going to watch this. I've said it before. So, David, thank you for being here. And Brendan, thank you one more time. I'm going to give you my hand one more time. Very American. We're gonna be best friends. I'm so excited that you guys could be here. And, Glenmorangie has been Glenmorangie, right? That's the Glenmorangie is the more American butcherization of it.
Oh, that's okay. People in Glasgow butcher it as well. They say Glenmorangie as well, but it's Glenmorangie. It's because of the word more. More means big. So if you come to Scotland, you'll see a lot of bars, restaurants that have the word more in it. So I get married in a place called Oran More, which means big song. Yeah. So it's because of that more. So it's Glenmore.
We're not very imaginative. There's actually, I think, at least three mountains in Scotland named Ben Moore.
Yeah.
And Ben means mountain.
Yeah,
big mountain. Times three.
That's another big one, David. Yeah, Ben Moore as well. Sometimes you stick an H in just to get a bit M-H-O-R. Yeah, so big, peaceful valley, Glenmorangie.
Yeah, I've been a fan for a while. I mean, and like you said, I know that it's funny. People develop this false sense of authority if you are from Scotland. Meaning that I've had the discussion over Islay versus Islay or Islay.
That's a short one. It's Islay.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you would think so, but there was actually a nice little documentary that was released a couple years ago about the whiskey on Islay, and the narrator who's got this accent, so you would think that he was correct, kept saying Islay.
Yeah.
Or Islay or something.
Islay or Islay.
And I know Islay. The documentary.
I remember wanting to pull my eyes out because I'm a huge Ardbeg fan, and then you guys are, even though I know we're drinking Glenmorangie.
That's Ardbeg.
Is it really?
No.
But it happens a lot.
People
say Ardbeg.
Ardbeg. No, they also say, so this one here is Nectar d'Or, but it gets called Nectar Dior.
Dior.
So it's like a collaboration with Christian.
I feel like Dior is it really a collaboration with Christian?
If it was Dior, it would be. Nectar Dior means golden liquid door, but for some reason it's become Dior.
So it is Nectar Dior.
Dior. Yeah,
Dior. Oh, okay. I thought you were saying it's Dior and people have been saying Dior wrong.
No, I've always
said Nectar Dior, so it's Dior. Yeah.
See, great that we've cleared this up for everyone.
it is great. That's the whole point of having these shows is you get all these urban legends. And that's we were talking about this before the show started, is we're at this age of the dissemination of information is so ripe right now. All you have to do is say something online and someone will be there to tell you you're wrong.
It's quite funny. Just before we came in here, we've seen an ad campaign, some mention in the competition, which I shouldn't be doing, but who cares?
Okay.
So I used to work at Oban Distillery on the west coast of Scotland. So we pronounce it Oban. It's spelled O-B-A-N, but it's Oban.
Yeah, like as if the B and the N run into each other.
Yes. So there's Oban. A big ad campaign right now that says it's pronounced, and then they phonetically put Oban, because in America people say Oban.
Oban.
But actually, when you look at Oban, what it means is Little Bay of Caves, and it's an ob. And a ban. So it's actually Americans that pronounce it right. Correct. And everyone in Scotland pronounces it wrong. But there's this patronizing campaign of actually it's pronounced Oban. And you can go, actually, it's not.
By the first time I ever went up to Tain, when I was trying to get a job with Glenmorangie, I went to the local bar one evening and was drinking some Glenmorangie, and a local came up to me and was sitting next to me, and he heard me ordering it and he corrected me on the pronunciation.
Oh my gosh.
It's Glenmorangie. And I thought, right, I'm going to pick my fights here using those words very carefully.
But that's a fight you should pick.
Well, you know, I didn't want to.
You should hand him your business card.
Well, that's exactly what I did. Right, I bought him a drink just before I left and handed him a business card and just said, nice meeting you, but you might want to check on the pronunciation. And then left very quickly.
Yeah. You know. And then called him an asshole on the way out the door.
But then unfortunately walked into a cupboard and
was waiting for me.
Went out the wrong way. Yeah. Well, you guys are endlessly loved here. I mean, most people's first introduction to a good single malt is the Glenmorangie tin.
I know.
But the 10-year-old is it's extremely reasonably priced. And the same thing with peat. When you first – I kind of stumbled backwards into peat. My first experience with scotch was an 18 Lefroy.
Okay.
I thought they were all smoky. I didn't know. And – but the Ardbeg also as well is just a great introduction to that category.
Sure.
And it's at a reasonably – I mean, it's a fantastic price.
Yeah.
So everything you guys are doing, as soon as I found out you guys were going to be here, I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be so much fun. I have many questions. I want to definitely dive into – I talk about the La Santa endlessly.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I think that's where we should start.
Okay. Sounds good. So what do you want to know?
Everything. Start from the beginning.
Yeah, so we're famous for finishing. So I work for Dr. Bill Lumsden. Dr. Bill's our director of whisky creation, which in a way is kind of like a master distiller and a master blender combined. And he's famous for really taking wood finishing that our company started with the 1987. In 1987, we released the Glenmorangie 1963, which is the first wood-finished whiskey. And Bill saw the potential in it, and he's really just mastered it and made all of these incredible whiskies. So these three that we're going to taste together all are wood-finished. So Glenmorangie, because of the way it's made, because of that mineral-rich water, our fermentation creates like just a huge array of esters. So it's fruity, and it's floral, and it's elegant. And then when we distill in the tallest copper pot stills, it kind of removes all of the sulfur. Pretty much all the sulfur is stripped out of the spirit. And that has a double effect. You don't taste sulfur, but it also helps you really pick apart all the different citrus and white fruits and flowers and cereal and biscuit notes that are in the spirit. So because of that, you make this fruity, clean, floral spirit. And it's kind of home. It belongs going into American white oak, ex-bourbon, American white oak casks. So if we want to make a sherry whiskey, it doesn't make sense to put it 12 years in sherry because there's so much effort put into making this incredible spirit that the sherry would just consume it because it is elegant, it is soft, it is light. So to get a sherried Glenmorangie, that's where Bill hit upon this idea. 10 years in ex-bourbon and then finish it, an additional 2 years in sherry. And up until very recently, up until about 4 years ago, it was Oloroso sherry, which is the most commonly used when you see sherry cask in whiskey. 99.9% of the time, it'll be Oloroso. Mm-hmm. You tend to call out if you use a different sherry. So until recently, it was 100% finished in Oloroso. Great for the spiciness, really brings in that dried fruit note and lots of spiciness, but it can be quite dry because Oloroso is a medium dry sherry. So it's, what we also do is it's about 75% now spends 2 years in Oloroso, and the other 25% spends 2 years in Pedro Jimenez. So
that's
Pedro,
what I was wondering, PX.
Mm-hmm. PX, super dark, rich, full of chocolate, full of raisins.
Fall flavors. I like to, to me, it reminds me of a lot of baked baked fruits, baked apple pies, baked, just those dark, dried, raisiny notes.
Sure,
and just like all the positive.
It's definitely the raisins. And with La Santa, the PX, it does add flavors, don't get me wrong, it does add flavors to it, but the main reason the PX is in there is to add texture. It gives it this kind of mouth coating, it gives it moisture, you know, it makes it kind of unctuous, to steal a word from the wine industry, which we do often.
And to steal another one, almost kind of slightly chewy on the palate.
That's stolen from Star Wars.
But. Is it? Yeah, that's right. That's not good.
Jesus. So for those who don't know, Brendan showed up 10 minutes before and has just been zinger after zinger. Yeah. All the way up until now. So
yeah, once the camera started, I went, shit. That's life.
Well, you know, I've always enjoyed y'all's limited edition releases. And I actually, you guys can't see off camera, we normally have our production guy, Jack, but today it's Brandon. And I actually gave him a bottle of the Glenmorangie. Yeah. Well, Brandon. Yeah, yeah, very similar.
You were close. Good enough. Well done.
Well, you know, like us Americans, we borrow from you, but just do it a little better. I gave him some Bacata.
There's so many non-PC things I can say to that.
It's a podcast. We can say what we want. So I gave him a bottle of Bacata, and I've seen it slowly dwindle away on his desk. I'm so in love with the, you know, bourbon is so huge right now that I know so many people who just refuse to branch off into scotch. They're so passionate about bourbon. One, because once you get over the, the import tax and everything, it tends to be a little bit more expensive than you're used to. Now bourbon is pricing itself out of the category.
Yes.
They're jumping all over it. But when I introduce people to scotch, that I know are big bourbon drinkers, I always go straight for the La Santa or the Quinta Rubin. Just those those finished whiskeys that have, or the Macallan 12, you know, you can get
language.
Here for.
Come on.
Yes. Sorry, my language.
Family show. This is a family show here. Come on.
Just those sherry bombs. You know, you want to introduce them to something that reminds them of bourbon, but not quite.
I actually
quite.
Find that the Nectar d'Or works really well, for me anyway, kind of bringing bourbon drinkers into single malts.
Really?
There's something about the influence of the Sauterne casks.
A sweetness.
There's a sweetness on the front end and a spiciness from the French oak that's really, it's obviously still a single malt, but there's a familiarity to the flavor progression that seems to really work for me. And the times I've done events in Kentucky, without a doubt, the favorite of our range amongst malt drinkers in Kentucky is the Nectar.
Really?
Absolutely, hands down. Yeah.
I mean, you guys cover the gamut of pricing as well. So stateside, we see the $30 range, the $40 range. You have two options in the $40 range, the Quinta Rubin and the Nectar d'Or. Sorry, I'll get used to it. Habits. The La Santa and Quinta Rubin. Yeah, the Nectar d'Or is in the $55, $60 range. But you've got a way to introduce and step up the entire range without breaking the bank, which, by the way, I know some really good bourbons that are not near as old in that same price range. So you're now – you see what I'm saying?
Yep.
Times have changed. You can get an 8-year-old bourbon for $45, or you can get a 12-year-old single malt for the same price.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting that one thing that hasn't really changed in perception is that a 10-year-old single malt is often regarded incorrectly as
young.
Maybe a bit too young or
very
young.
Yeah, yeah,
but
an
8-year-old bourbon is regarded as a really old bourbon now.
Yeah.
How does this work?
I can play devil's advocate here. And I think the difference between those fresh, heavily charred American oak barrels that are used one time versus some used barrels,
I think the temperature.
And the temp. I mean, extreme temperatures.
I was at Willett. this visit, so I spent a weekend in Louisville, first time ever, and I was in the top of one of the warehouses with Drew, the master seller at Willett.
I want to get him on so bad.
Oh, he's a cracking guy. Yeah, you need to get him on. But he took us up, and I always knew it was hotter at the top than it is at the bottom, but I thought it would be minimal. But it's like a sauna.
It's a nightmare.
So, yeah, I think age per category needs to be considered on its own. Yeah,
sure.
But it still does. I do find it confusing that people will pay the same price for a 6-year-old bourbon that's made with like a cereal grain that's not barley, and we're 100% barley and 10 years. It is considerably more expensive to me.
I mean, the amount of effort that goes into it, it's not that bourbon is it's not that effort's not put into it. It's just this weird,
it's just part of supply and demand, I guess.
Bourbon's
fantastic.
I mean, bourbon's great. Yeah. In fact, we're doing a show right after. There's this, which I think I'm going to air that one first. There's a new Texas organization that's coming out that's going to ruffle a lot of feathers, that's trying to fix some problems in the industry, and they're going to be here shortly after. I'm a huge bourbon guy. I started with Scotch. I think that what you do, I mean, we've been to Ardbeg. My wife and I spent a few days on Islay, and I know everyone listening to this is, he's going to tell the Islay story again, but but we stayed in Port Ellen in a cottage just outside, near the floor maltings at
Lafroig.
The Port Ellen floor maltings.
Oh, the maltings.
Oh, yeah, the malting.
It's a drum malting.
Yeah, yeah. So we're like maybe I don't want to say kilometer because that's just.
That'll be fine. I get that. But it's on the edge of town, malting side of town. So that's where I used to live.
Right next to it.
There's a neighborhood there, and there's actually a cottage that's kind of set into the hillside a little bit.
I think you're in Imra Vale, it's called. Imra Vale is this little road.
Yes, it's a very tiny.
And I lived there as well. So I used to live on Islay. I lived on Islay for 3 years.
We stayed there because I'm a huge, that whole three distillery thread is like my favorite whiskey heaven.
Yeah.
And that's, for those who don't know, is Ardbeg, Lafroig, and Lagavulin. And we had to walk to Ardbeg because we couldn't get a taxi.
Uh-huh. And, Uber hasn't made it to Islay yet.
No, it's like Jennifer's taxi service, and it's Jennifer and her van. And
that's right. Need to call it in advance.
We've
got a city bike now.
No, we don't.
That
was nice. But you guys
have to be city trikes.
You guys have this beautiful cafe, and you can have a nice lunch, and then they take you through. And walking through your distillery, it seemed everything was wood. Right, the walkways were wood. The framing was wood. It had this very old world feel to it, which they all do in their own way. But it was one of the nicest experiences. And then we got pulled to that little side room where you have that archive of every
study
of every arc. You know,
that's so, pretty cool.
So huge fan. Like, legitimately, just love everything you got. Both Glenmorangie and Ardbeg are doing so.
Oh, thank you.
With that being said, I think I have a little bit more Bacalta. Do you guys want to pour something other than that? Let's start with the Los Santos. That's right. So we jumped into that.
Yeah. Stay with the Los Santos. It's proofed at 86.
It's this one.
Left to right.
Yes.
Left to right. Yeah. I'm gonna tell you. I bet I could blind do this.
Yeah, Los Santos will be. Yeah. The darkest in color.
I got it.
And it'll have that spicy kick to it. But I just get chocolate from the start to the end, milk chocolate all the way from the very first taste right through to the end. Big spiciness, cinnamon, even chili.
Is there a little, I think I may have got these backwards. Is there a little peated malt in the door?
No, so that's quite common for
the phenolic.
And for nectar, people sometimes think it has a bit of peat in it. It's just the tannins.
Yeah.
It's just the tannins coming through. So we get quite often someone saying, oh, that, you know, I really like that one. It's the peaty one. And I'll be like thinking Finalta, which was the second private edition, or Dornoch, like a travel retail one-off. It was a really good whiskey, but it was just a one-off batch for travel retail. And they're like, no. And they'll say, oh, it's the one with the black label. And I'm like, Quinta. It's like, it's Quinta Ruban. I was like, there's no peat in it. And they'll say, no, though, there is. And I'm like, there's not. It just presents, like, the port and the whiskey. It's like, I don't know, one out of 20 people will pick up this kind of peatiness. And also with nectar, because it's in French oak, and French oak is just absolutely rammed full of tannins.
Right.
Yeah. When the tannins come in, it's a spiciness that I get, but some people it comes up as like
a little
really
smoky,
light smokiness. Yeah.
And it's the secret to why that's a balanced whiskey.
Yeah.
If it didn't have those pretty intense tannins, it would be so lopsided. sweet on the front end and nothing else, it would be syrupy and, you know, unbalanced. So we have to have that tannin level. Thankfully, French oak's perfect for that.
Yeah.
So if you think about using maybe a different type of
sweet
white wine that isn't in French oak, chances are it's not going to work quite as well.
Yeah, you run the risk of it just becoming sugar. Yeah. It's super sweet.
Yeah, and I think that's why you said, and I meant to mention this earlier, Americans love their sugar. So if you do have a ton of these bourbon drinkers who love the door, it's probably because of that. That sweet, it reminds them of the sugar.
I was just thinking about that, how you were saying that some people pick up the tannins in the Quinta as smoke.
Yep.
And maybe from a bourbon drinker's perspective, who's used to something that's sweeter and a bit more oily, I guess, because the corn. If you've got a drier whiskey to start with, the tannins there are going to present themselves differently to tannins with a big load of sweetness over it. So this is a drier whiskey than a bourbon, that's for sure. Mm. Those tannin levels may well come across to a bourbon drinker's palate that's tuned for bourbon as more of a smokiness because there's not the sweetness there with it.
So Quinta Rubin, okay. I've been saying Quinta Rubin this whole time like a redneck.
It's deliberate. We just make it impossible for people to pronounce all of our things.
I would love for you guys to come out with something that was just not Gaelic at all. Like just
just called Davy.
Yeah, just David. Yeah. Just like
I was just thinking.
So if you're called David in Glasgow, you're called Davy. So if you just call it Glenmorangie, Davy.
That's a great idea. Let's do it. I was thinking, you were saying your trip to Isla. I'm impressed that you got off the island and you weren't kept there because you do look quite a lot like you might come from Isla.
So we shortly afterwards, we did the DNA test thing. And my family's just basically, there's no Asian DNA. There's no African DNA. Yeah. It is just basically a big circle around Scotland and Ireland. And it really shines through the beard. Yeah. I mean, if you shave my beard, it just mostly looks blonde. But
it's a shame. If you told me, I could have just given you that information. You wouldn't have had to have paid for a DNA test.
just wrote it down.
There you go.
What do you want to be? What
trust
do you
me.
Want to be?
Trust me, that's where you're from. Yeah. But yeah, the names are, so obviously our sherry finish, our port finish, and our Sauternes finish. I've just been down in Mexico City, and it's quite funny. Everyone was saying, why did you call it the Saint? For La Santa. It's not the Saint. La Santa is Gaelic. In Scottish, it means warmth or passion. I mean, the main reason I would say is warmth, because this is quite spicy, quite intense. It's that, you know, definite spicy notes, so some bigger, more caramelized flavors. So a bit more intense, a bit more warming. Quinta Rubin, we use ruby port. So Rubin and ruby, it's just a Scottish word. But Quinta is what you call a winery in Portugal. So we buy it from Quintas around Portugal, this ruby port, so Quinta Rubin. And then the much mispronounced in America, Nectar d'Or.
I will be pushing that.
Yeah.
It'll be Nectar d'Or from here.
Nectar d'Or is the correct name, which means golden liquid. So it was in mythology, that's what the gods drank at Olympus and stuff like that. They drank nectar to get their strength. And d'Or means gold. So golden liquid. And it's because we use this golden syrupy Sauternes wine to make that. But because of, I don't know if it's the apostrophe, I don't know if it's pronunciation, but in America it's constantly called Nectar d'Or.
There's a French Armagnac called, we've always pronounced it instinctually, La Encantada.
Okay.
Because they use a little apostrophe after the L. Uh-huh. And we still don't know if that's correct or not. We've heard L'Encantada.
Okay.
We've heard La Encantada. It's instinct as Americans to, that apostrophe is a little sound, like a little... lead into the next thing. So, I mean, I get it. I mean, I've been calling it Nectar d'Or this whole time.
If you're in doubt how to pronounce that Armagnac, just say Glenmorangie.
Yeah, order that every time.
Mm. Always such a fan. Do you ever get tired of, I mean, what's your BAC like? What's your blood alcohol content on a regular, I mean, you guys are going to, I know that when they bring these extravagant figures in town all the way from Scotland, that you guys are constantly doing one thing after the next.
Sure.
You know, I talked to Mike Raymond over at Reserve 101.
Oh, yeah. No,
and as soon as I said that you were on the show, there was one of the bartenders, Ryan, was like, oh, man, I had so much fun drinking with Brendan before we opened. But then when we opened, I was miserable the rest of the day, like just hitting it too hard early in the morning. But he said he had a great time with you.
Yeah, this is the funny thing, because I always get asked the same question. So most of my job is in a sensory lab, nosing, tasting. making sure our batches of Glenmorangie Original are right, or whatever batches are coming in, and nosing and tasting new make spirit for both Ardbeg and Glenmorangie. But you don't actually drink, you know, or you might drink
a little bit,
the tiniest little droplet, and you work on only a few batches in a day. You know, you'll be looking at some new makes in the morning, then you'll be doing some more boring stuff, and then you'll be looking at a batch in the afternoon. And it's the same when you're on the road. I mean, there are nights where it's like a more social event. You're having a meal with people where you are naturally just drinking some really good scotch. But those events where you're in a bar and showing people like your newest wares, or you're talking about like a core range, it's, you tend to be talking. So everyone else is drinking and you're talking.
Yeah.
So it's actually, it's not that bad at all.
It's a perception thing.
Yeah, it's a perception thing. Because when you do a masterclass, people might have six whiskies. We tend to try and limit it to six. That's a sort of a responsible amount. Sometimes if you go up to eight because you have stuff to cover and you'll drop the content, but those people will drink eight whiskies. But you, honestly, we do change them round, but after that masterclass, I could probably just use the same set again because I'm just talking for an hour and try to let people know what they're looking for. It's everyone who's listening.
Yeah, you wouldn't be, your public speaking abilities wouldn't be wouldn't be so great.
Well, it depends on how
they already are.
You definitely want to promote responsible drinking. I just even doing the show, it's an interesting experiment in sitting down in a conversation. And although we're talking, this is just a slightly hotter version of being in a pub together.
Yeah.
Having
yeah.
drinks, you know, yeah. so yeah. it's, you know, the time gets away from you, you get sucked into conversation. And it wasn't so much the amount that I was curious about, but the schedule. I mean, everyone I've had come on the show that came in from out of town was literally like, okay, we're doing the show at this time. We're doing some industry education right after the show. Then we're doing a dinner tonight, and we're doing a dinner tomorrow night. Yep. And you know, and I'll be at the dinner tomorrow night. I know you guys are doing one.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a huge Dan Crowell fan, so I'm.
Why?
I think he's one of the nicest guys, man. Like,
he's awesome. Dan's awesome.
He believed in. I host a whiskey festival here locally. And when we created it, it was to fix all of the frustrations with all the other events. Uh-huh. Okay. Apparently, there's a lot of like very common frustrations for you guys traveling the world and seeing all these festivals. And so I approached Dan as well as a bunch of other folks, and I was like, "Hey, what do you hate about these events?" And we just got rid of all their frustrations. And so Dan believed early on when we were like 200 people.
Yep.
And this year we hit 1,000. So
nice.
Awesome. I think he's such a nice guy. So, but I haven't got to sit down with him the way that I'm sitting down with you guys. So I'm hoping to get to know him a little better.
You'll get some time. The schedules are punishing. Yeah. I mean, it's partly self-inflicted, but yesterday I was in Maryland. I flew from Maryland, so I did events all day. Well, there's a long story to where I was in Maryland as well. So I landed at Dulles. I had to get an Uber to Annapolis. Then I checked my schedule and all of my events were in Baltimore. So I kind of was just Ubering around Maryland for some reason. But I did a full day of events. I finished my final fifth event of the day at 7 p.m. And then got an Uber to the airport, get to the airport for about 8, fly at 10, land here. Probably got to my hotel room at about 1 in the morning. And then me and David met for lunch to go over the schedule for the next couple of days at 8. Something like that.
Yeah, about that.
And then we'll be out today now. So there's little breaks here and there.
Sure,
but you're on a full schedule.
Right.
I mean, it balances out. It costs a lot of money to come out here. It takes a lot of time.
You've got to make it the biggest impact you can. Yeah. And I understand that's how it works.
I gain when I go back home. Because when I go back home, I'll do like a, you know, I'll be in the office at 8:30 and I'll be there till 5. But it's very rare when you're making whiskey that something comes up that makes you have to like pull an all-nighter. You know, it's not like, this whiskey might not be ready in 8 years' time. Right, cancel everything. We're doing an all-nighter.
Yeah.
So it's a much more regular job. And I travel maybe 10 weeks of the year. That's what I'm limited to because the other 40 weeks of the
year, you've got a job to do. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great. I like the intensity of this. I do like the busyness.
In short bursts.
And it's a two-week burst. Yeah. And then like on that flight home, you sleep like the
like
dead.
A baby.
It really is amazing. But yeah, it's expected and it is cool. You kind of get this, I don't know if nervous energy is the right word, but you feed off of it and you just keep going.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
We'll make it real quick and then we're going to jump into Quinta Ruban.
Okay.
So I have a, I'm a whiskey guy. I drink whiskey neat, and no pun intended. I have a guilty pleasure, and that guilty pleasure that I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily want too many people in public seeing me walk up, hey, what's up? You know, it's the whiskey guy, and I'm drinking a pina colada.
Okay.
So, although that is what I really like. I really like a sweet tooth.
Okay.
Is there something that when you just are tired of dealing with single malts, and this question's for both of you, that there is something, even if it's a something that might be embarrassing, something in Coke or something, you know, is there something that you guys drink?
Well, big thing in Scotland as a whole, probably, and especially whiskey makers, is beer. I mean, yeah. I love beer.
But I wouldn't be embarrassed of beer.
Yeah. Beer's great. Wouldn't be embarrassed by beer. But the thing is, and I'm now going to eliminate half of our clientele here, sure. which is obviously not a great.
Are you going to say American beer is trash?
People get upset. No, no, people get obsessed with craft beer that's been, you know, distilled through 8 socks and served in a shoe. You know, there's only a small amount. There's some good. Just because someone has a big brewery doesn't mean their beer's no good. And there's a beer in Scotland that David always attacks me for. But I love to drink Tennent's.
I was about to say Tennent's.
Tennent's Lager, the big T. It's a great, clean, fresh, well-made lager. So that's one. Real guilty pleasures. You'd never catch me drinking a pina colada. I'm super sensitive to coconut.
We picked
this up during the sensory. So like my wife is banned from all kind of coconut flavored moisturizers.
So you hate it or you're allergic?
I am. No, just super sensitive to it. So if something's strongly coconut, it's like 100,000 times.
Pina colada's
coconut
got pineapple in it as well, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Pineapple is the only fruit on the planet that I just can't be near.
Yeah, it's got that enzyme. It's got an enzyme in it that really freaks some people out.
I can't go near
the way it makes your mouth feel?
Just to taste it. I pick up this sort of vomitous thing off pineapple.
There's an enzyme in pineapple that a lot of people are allergic to.
That enzyme breaks down meat.
Yeah.
It tenderizes meat. So when you eat too much pineapple, your mouth gets numb. It's because that enzyme is literally breaking down.
It's not so much that I don't like it. I've never had that happen. It's, for me, actually, it is linked to the fact that there's an enzyme that breaks down meat. When I was really young schoolboy in Scotland, we used to get served really cheap.
So that was boiled 60 years ago 60. For anyone listening.
my ration book.
Yeah, during the war.
During the war. We used to get really cheap boiled gammon steaks with a pineapple ring on top to try and, it was obviously to try
add
and
some flavor to dress it up a little bit.
To acidify it as well.
And the whole thing was just so awful.
It scarred you. I can't do it. I'm the same way with pineapple. Christmas stuffing. There's something in it that I'm a grown man.
Sage.
And I'm a father of 4 and a proud husband, but if you put stuffing in my mouth, I throw up. There's something about it that initiates a gag reflex. I can't do it. Yeah. But
so just to assure everyone, there's no pineapple or stuffing in our whiskey.
So you'll never ever pick up a coconut note in Ardbeg or Glenmorangie because
you will. Then, so it's just I'm super sensitive to, so when it's just on its own, so what I have to be careful, this is why you have a panel of people when you do sensory. You don't do it all on your own. So I'm extra sensitive to coconut.
Sure.
So when you make Glenmorangie Original, you only use the cask twice. So you have first fill casks and second fill casks. First fill is obviously the most active cask we have, and that has a very clear coconut note in it. But sometimes I'll go, oh, this one's far too strong. It's too high in coconut. And everyone else will admit, knows it and go, no, it's pretty fine. And then I'm not as sensitive to like grassy notes, this green grassy note. So sometimes I'll miss that completely when other people see it. It's just strengths and weaknesses. Everyone's good at picking out certain things. But I'll always pick up coconut and Glenmorangie Original. But it's just a small amount, which is probably invisible to most people, but I'll pick it up. It's just sensitivities.
What I love about that is that people often get so kind of sensitive, so paranoid about their own opinions about a whiskey. And they're kind of like, oh, am I right?
Well, sure, they don't want to embarrass themselves.
You are right, because there's thousands of different aromas that could be picked up by a human palate in every glass of whiskey. Yep. But any one human being's palate can only pick up a tiny subset of those. Fascinating concept that if you're doing a whiskey tasting and presenting to a group of 30 people, there's a pretty high chance that everyone in the room is tasting completely different subsets.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some overlap because Jack Daniels has that banana note, but I agree with you. There's some notes. I attend that my wife has a much better nose than I do, and we will be drinking whiskey, and I always pick up on a certain note with certain brands, and that's what my mind goes to.
Yep.
And then she'll say something, and I'm like, I didn't even pick up on that. Yeah. But then all of a sudden, I'm picking up on it.
Yeah.
And it's something that you're right. So the different people, different noses, they're going to, you know.
Sure.
Attach themselves to certain things. This is absolutely fantastic.
This is
actually the first, besides, so I used to listen to Ralphie when I first got into this.
Oh, yeah.
Ralphie. Yeah, so Ralphie was like my go-to reviewer on YouTube. He still is amazing.
It's a good place still to go to, yeah.
Very well loved. And he recommended the...
Advising the competition.
He recommended the 10-year. And that's where I got my introduction to the brand. Then I went to the Quinta because initially, weirdly enough, 2 years ago, the Quinta was slightly less expensive than the La Santa, and now it's the other way around.
Mm.
Now the Quinta is slightly more expensive, at least here in the States.
It should be. Quinta should be more expensive slightly than La Santa.
Slightly, but more expensive. Correct. Yeah, just slightly. So I first fell in love with the Quinta, then got to the La Santa, and I was just – it's so – we talk about drinkability a lot when it comes to – how much you enjoy it, how easy it is to drink, how it's not super aggressive, so you don't have to, you know, the ABV is not cash strength, so you don't have to tone it down too much. It's just absolutely delicious.
Yeah, Quinta is about as high as we'll go with a Glenmorangie. So for me, Glenmorangie, well, in the States, so pretty much everywhere else on earth, Glenmorangie original is 80 proof. So in the States, it's 86.
Mm-hmm.
It's half a historic reason, bureaucracy, legislature back in the day, and it's just become a tradition and it stays. So you guys get an extra 6 proof for free, so you're welcome. Everywhere else, it's 80, pretty much. I say between 80 proof and 92 proof is kind of where Glenmorangie is at its best. It kind of opens up and you get that complexity. And without complexity... you could argue you don't have Glenmorangie. The only ones that we go high with are the Astars. And to be honest with you, Astar, which I love, I'm always going to add water to it.
I haven't tasted it. I know where there's one bottle on the shelf.
Sure.
Yeah, so I've seen it on the shelf. I don't know much about it. There's a great little shop on the south side of town called NASA Liquor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great, depending on whether you're a customer or if you're a rep, because apparently it's quite the driven store. They really try to get in as much as they can.
Okay.
And they've got this panel, this billboard effect of Glenmorangie offerings that are just, it's a great little, if you want to go in. I mean, it's a little bit of a drive from here. It'd be about 40 minutes, but that's nothing in Houston traffic.
Yeah, that's like if you two
want
blocks.
That, if you want that bottle of Astar, you better get down there before this goes out.
Oh, yeah?
It's a one batch, one off.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Not to be repeated.
I should call them and find out if they still got it.
So we made it in 2017. Astar is, in simple terms, Astar could be a Glenmorangie original made only using first fill casks.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an accurate way to describe it, but it doesn't tell the story at all.
Right.
So Astar's born out of our constant research, constantly striving to get the very best casks, which we do, but then trying to work out how can we make the very best casks even better. So we'll order casks from the Bourbon County, so we'll order from Brown-Forman Cooperage, some other cooperages, and they'll take in the best casks, grade them, and we're looking for heavily toasted, lightly charred casks made of American white oak, clearly, air-seasoned, ideally, and filled with bourbon for 4 years. But we know that there's going to be natural variation in that. Sometimes the char will be a little bigger or a little weaker. Maybe the bourbon's been in for 5 years, you know.
Sure.
And then we balance that all off in our first and second fill cask to make original.
I mean, 4 years with bourbon, it still has a lot of the original barrel.
Yeah, well, that's the key. So sometimes people approach me and they say, I've got some great bourbon casks. They're 10 years, so they're going to cost double the amount, but they're 10 years. And I'm like, actually...
I prefer the younger.
That's made them less...
Valuable
to me. I'd still take them and do an experiment with them, but I need 4 years because that just takes the right edge off the barrel and then it comes to me perfect. But there's this natural variation and we deal with that after 10 years and we bring it together to make the unbelievably consistent original. But we buy a handful, a very, very small, not quite a handful. We buy a very small amount of casks each year, which are called our designer casks. And this is, we stipulate the very trees that we buy in the Ozarks and the Mark Twain Forest. We have them cut down the way that we want. We have them air seasoned for the exact time that we require, which is over 2 years. We then have
that's
them,
a long
yeah,
air
it's
season.
A long air season. So we give them a 2-year air season minimum. Yeah. Some of them go a little longer.
That's
then we have them charred, exactly toasted to our spec, and they all happen at the same time. Exactly charred to our spec, then filled, and it's almost like we have one bourbon that I can't mention. It's a confidentiality thing, but we have one bourbon. Bill will come on.
Does
here
it
and
rhyme with
it.
Levin Hill?
Probably doesn't, but okay. Let's just say maybe, but no. but this bourbon, they fill it, and it's almost like they and they start the timer, and when it clicks 4 years exactly, they remove them. So it's a when it comes to us, it's a first fill cask.
Sure,
but it's kind of like having a really good off the peg suit, like I do, versus getting a made to measure suit. You know,
sure,
every single nothing is left to chance. So you have this absolute perfection first fill cask. It forms like 10-15% of the heart of original. We want to buy more. We want to double, triple, quadruple the amount of these casks, even though they are very expensive. But the cooperages that make it for us just can't. They're like, we just do not have the ability. We can't scale this supply chain. This is your limit. This is what you get. So when we every so often we'll pull just a batch of these designer casks, as they're called, and we'll make an Aster. So Bill made it in 2007, mm-hmm. last time.
Yeah,
he made two or three batches, I think it was. Two or three, maybe.
There was just the one bottling.
One bottling, but it was a few batches in there, I think.
You're right, that doesn't tell the story.
It's 2017. I loved Aster. So my favorite Glenmorangie is original. So Aster is like original on steroids, as Dr. Bill says.
Right.
Although Bill pronounces things funny, so he says steroids.
Yeah.
But the point is there. It's like Glenmorangie on steroids. But it's like a big, pumped up Glenmorangie original. And the one in 2007 was released at 114.2 proof. And that was the one thing I didn't like about it, in a way, because I always added water. And I just
you want to go down
better
a little high.
And better and better.
Yeah.
But when people were talking to us, they always say, why don't you do a Glenmorangie that's higher proofed? And I explained this as well. When you add the water, it actually gets better, you see, because I do that in the lab. And it was a few people said, well, we don't get the opportunity to do that, which kind of was like,
which is interesting. I've said that a lot. When you make, I'm sure they have powdered lemonade in the UK.
Yep.
I would much rather add my own water and make it as unsweet as possible at my own level. Like, I'd rather do it myself.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, be in control.
Yeah. And you get more of a raw product. So I agree with you completely. A little dash of water can definitely open
things up. So with Aster, I talked Bill into it. I was like, we should make it. And he's like, yeah, well, I've done it before and I've done this. And you don't necessarily want to revisit old expressions and just re-release them all the time. He says something, and he's right. He says that could be perceived as lazy. But I was like, I think it was when he looked at his diary and he's like, gosh, that's been 10
years.
So he set me the task of sort of pulling together. And I made one thing where I was like, I just don't think it can be 57.1. I just thought that was the one thing that was too high. But I kind of knew in my head it couldn't go below 50, 100 proof.
Sure.
Otherwise, you can't
really call
it Aster.
It'll be too different. Yeah.
It's too different. So we arrived at 105.
So it's coming again?
It came in 2017.
No, I'm sorry. When's the next? Are you guys planning another 10 years from now? Or is this going to be like a once every decade thing?
Possibly. It's not in the plan, so I'm not being overly coy. I would love to do it again, because this one that came out in 2017 was a hit.
It was phenomenal.
A massive hit. Yeah. But I was more just talking about that as it's the one time that Glenmorangie kind of goes out of this 80 to 92 proof thing, which then, in a very roundabout way, brings me back to Quinta.
Yeah.
So Quinta Ruban is
well
at... Thank you. Like a young Billy Connolly. that's the only time anyone will compare me to Billy Connolly. Quinta is 92. So it's higher proofed, as is Nectar. These are a bit higher, but it keeps in the intensity of the casks that we're in. It keeps that colour, first of all. Mm-hmm. I love Quinta for just this almost unique reddish, orange, pink hue that it picks up. And when you use ruby red port casks, ruby port casks, we use two types of cask. So we use barriques. So barriques are smaller casks. 225 litres. So that means there's a bigger ratio of wood to whiskey. So when you empty a barrique, it comes out like, I always say Ribena in the UK, but there's no Ribena here, is there? So grape juice, blackcurrant juice, almost pink. It has this unbelievable bright pink. And then we also use port pipes. A port pipe would barely fit in this studio. They are massive. Yeah. 660, 670 litres will go in there. So three times the size. Much bigger whiskey to wood, or a much smaller wood to whiskey ratio. So when you empty that one out, it comes out almost like this colour. It comes out like burnished copper, like a sort of deep copper colour. And then you marry those two together to get this consistent colour and consistent flavour. So there's even more goes into it. I've got a picture on my Instagram for a plug. But there's a picture, I put some pictures up of just how these two whiskies look next to each other. And there's a real noticeable difference between them.
What's your Instagram so people
can... It's just my name. So it's MCC_Brendan. I'm not very social media savvy. That made sense to me.
MCC_Brendan.
Yeah, because it's Brendan McCarran. But yeah, you can see pictures like these two different colours, and then we bring them together to make this consistent kind of flavour. And what you're looking for, so it's still complex, it still has like quite a range of flavour, but to me it has like three big, punchy, primary flavours. So it has this dark chocolate, real high cocoa dark chocolate. And take a sip, you can almost feel the powdery sensation you get off dark chocolate when you take a sip of it. It has honey, which is a classic Glenmorangie kind of marker. But it's like substantial. It's like thick honey, not runny honey. It's thick. Bees, like honeycomb, beeswax, manuka honey, all these kind of more substantial, even candied honey, if you've ever had that. So it kind of lasts much longer. And some people get this, some people don't, but there's like a minty eucalyptus finish.
I don't get the eucalyptus.
So try one. Take a tiny sip of it, and after you've sipped, start thinking about it, and you almost feel it creeping over the top of your mouth. Like, don't worry if you don't get it. Some people just don't get it, but there is this, just this bright, fresh.
I don't get it. I do, however, pick up that biscuit note.
Yep.
That from the standard Glenmorangie that was one of the first notes I picked up in a non-peated expression. I had a bottle of Bruichladdich Rocks. Has a very dinner roll, biscuity, you know, very, very yeast roll type note.
Yeasty and malty.
Yeah, and that's that. When I first picked that out, I felt like a total expert. I was like, I got this, right? I'm a nosing and tasting expert. Speaking of Bill Lumsden.
Yep.
So there was a guy locally. He's a little outside of town named Paul Hansen. Paul Hansen tweeted in to Mark Gillespie on Whiskey Cast because Mark had asked his people to, hey, I'm going to have Bill on the show. Ask me a question to ask him and I'll give it to him. So Paul had asked him, talking about the Elanta and how great it was, how well it was received, basically asked if you guys had any intention of coming out with an expression to add to the core range that was just ex-bourbon,
bourbon, so virgin oak.
Oak. Yeah, that's right. The question was about virgin oak. Yeah.
So, well, two ways to answer it. Never say never is one way. But also, there's no plan. There's no plan to remake Elanta. We get a lot of requests to remake Elanta because it was such a hit. But I'd actually say we get more requests to remake Sinalta, which was the first private edition. So then to make it even more confusing, some people mistakenly associate Astar as being the first private edition, but it wasn't. But it was maybe the one-off special batch that inspired the private edition. But we get lots of requests to remake Sinalta, which we could do, you know, because it's a big PX sherried Glenmorangie. And with Elanta, it's just fully matured in virgin American white oak. So Bill, he often says we don't want to reheat cold soup, is like his phrase for this. The private editions are there as like a conversation starter.
Sure.
You know, it's meant to be, or some people saying the best private edition hands down is, and someone else saying no way, it's clearly this one. Right. Some are meant to be quite a deliberate step away from the house style. You could say that with, I would say probably Artane had quite a big one. Sinalta had quite a big step away. Milshan, just super sweet. Mm-hmm. Some are meant to be a more technical, maybe geeky, just a slight adjustment to the process parameters to show what can happen. To sale, you know, using a brewer's barley rather than using a distiller's barley. Which I'll admit, in my head, if I get asked that before it had been made, I would say there'll be no difference. Or the difference will be so small to be...
No one will taste it.
Yeah, completely... Yeah. Blind, but it didn't. It became more biscuity, it became more malty. The barley showed up much more in the spirit. So they're meant to do that to like start this conversation, get people talking about how the flavors move. And even though some just sort of grab people's hearts and last, they aren't there to then become, you know, permanent additions mm-hmm. to the range. We'll always look at a range and we might look to change things from time to time, but if every single person who had a favourite private edition asked for us to make it as a permanent expression, then guess what? Every single private edition yeah. there's ever been would come out as a permanent edition. But there's no denying, after the success of Atlanta using Virgin Oak, we have like a Duthac, which is one of our travel retail, and that has, it's Duffock actually, Duffock, which has some new char in it. We've also done experiments with new char oak in some of our Glenmorangies for the future. Mm-hmm. And actually, we transferred some of that learning into Ardbeg, so the new Anno, the newest Ardbeg, the first permanent Ardbeg in 10 years. It has a healthy proportion of new char oak in the recipe. Yeah. So it kind of inspires other things. But I don't know. Never say never, but I doubt that we're going to, you know, relaunch like an Atlanta.
That, I feel like that's a more definitive answer. When Bill had answered it the first time, Paul, who had asked the question,
that means
like,
I'm fired. So.
Yes, so I mean,
well, can someone take my mic off?
Bill was being very cheeky in his response, and so
it's not like him.
But. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. So you've got some notes there. Did you have anything you wanted to touch back
no,
on?
No, I was just keeping track of the conversation. Yeah, yeah. I guess the one thing I'd add to that is that that might. You could take that if you are an Atlanta lover of Atlanta as kind of a bad news, but you shouldn't, because what we're focused on is bringing you the next very different from Atlanta, but equally enthralling and delicious, yeah. surprising whiskey. The whole point is it's supposed to surprise and enthrall.
Yeah.
And trust me, I'd get fired from what little I know that you've told me, but there is a lot of fun stuff coming.
Coming yeah. down the way. What yeah. what of that fun stuff are you allowed to share?
Nothing.
Something?
Nothing.
Oh, that kills me.
So, go on, I'll let you in a secret. So in January next year, we will release a private edition.
Like, yeah.
Just like we've done every January.
But we don't know what it is yet.
That's a secret.
It's quite a big thing. It's going to be the 10th time that we've released a private edition.
Okay, so special. It's an anniversary.
Exactly. Yeah. The focus on private editions is about being innovative, absolutely respecting our heritage and the heritage of Scotch, but trying to do things that have never been done before. And this one has never been done before.
Okay.
So I'll give you that.
Okay.
By anybody.
All right, so I'm going to have to start looking on the TTB Cola website for y'all's label.
Yes.
Like every day, just kind of searching for it. Real quick, and this is just for my own sake, is it Milshan? That's how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
So they're always hard to pronounce, but Gaelic words, so our archivist, a guy called Ian Russell that told me this, is you tend to hit the first syllable hard. So it's Milshan. So that's why it's not Milshan, it's Milshan. So it's really hard for valley girls who like to, you know, go up with the last syllable.
Sure,
Gaelic is not a language for them. Is it like Milshan? So Milshan, and it means pudding or sweet things. I'm the head of maturing whiskey stocks, which is my job, but I'm also the replacement for Bill in the long term. But with whiskey, I mean, I've been here for 5 years almost. It's probably going to be a 10-year handover plan minimum. But over time, I'll just sort of take on more responsibilities, get involved in more stuff. And it's just a natural way to like protect a brand that's been around, protect a distillery, sorry. In Ardbeg's case, it's been around for 200 years. And to protect another one, it's been around for 175 years. 175. So you need to put some proper long-term planning. I mean, it could get to the stage where Bill is still in that role. I am very close to taking over from him. And you could already have my successor coming in. You know, or you could have two successors or three successors.
Have them lined up.
Yeah. It's succession for, you know, CEOs and stuff like that have it for big companies, but it takes, like they say, what, a year to 2 years to learn these massive businesses that cover the entire world. But because our products just take so long, and it's easy to get 90% of what Bill does, you get there, and I had quite a lot of it already from my career, but it's like to go from 90 to 92 takes years, and then you can imagine what it's like to go from 98 to 100, you know, it's really, really long term.
Just slow experience. Process, yeah. It's like maturing whiskey.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's like watching the spirit. I'll pull a cask that I say is really good. Bill will pull a cask that says it's absolutely brilliant. And it's like, how do you figure that out? Talk me through what you're seeing in this that's brilliant. I'll see a cask and I go, oh, you know, that's got quite a ways to go. But Bill will agree sometimes. He goes, great, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Other times he'll go, no, this is full of potential. Because 10 years ago, I found a bunch of casks like this. And what you do is, if you add them to sherry, it really pops. So we'll make that part of the 18-year-old for 6 years' time and stuff. It's these things that are really, really hard to pick up. You can only learn them when they happen, and they don't happen that often. So that's why it's a very long process.
Do you, as you go through and you check a barrel that's in development, do mm-hmm. you ever mark the barrel with notes or something?
Yes. Yeah. We have a really rudimentary database for all our casks, you know? And so that's how we pull samples. So I'm at my sensory lab. David, who works on me, is like the owner of that database. He's our head of blending. And he'll know what I say. Can we get some first fills from, you know, 8 years ago? Can we get some second fills from 7 years ago? Can we get some designer casks, the ones I talked about for Astar? Can you pull me a range of those, all the ones we have in stock, from youngest to oldest? All this kind of stuff. And every so often, something shows up. We have one designer cask, and that's as far as I'll go, which is just supercharged. And we do, obviously, sensory analysis on it, but we even did some analysis of the wood extractives that were in it, and it was like double what it should be in anything else. Wow. So that one is absolutely set aside in our warehouse. You know, it's like right next to the Ark from Indiana Jones, the two, like hidden away in a corner that no one will find them.
Elvis is guarding it.
Yeah, exactly. Elvis and Jimmy Hoffa are standing guard in one shift. So, yeah, every so often you do that. And the other time is every so often the spirit will come off and it's not right. So our spirit should be clean and fruity at Glenmorangie, and it should be super smoky and kind of have this vegetal, mulchy, metallic thing for our beg. That's the perfect. You have a very hot summer, which is rare in Scotland, but we actually have had one this year. It can.
Yeah, I heard you got to like 70 degrees or something.
Yeah, people were dying. It was horrible. I got a tan, which was, you know, the first time ever.
But it's peeled off already.
Yeah. When I have a tan, you can't see. When I have a tan, you can't see my veins. So it was really weird. But when that happens, it becomes harder to make whiskey. You know, whiskey belongs in the cold. That's where it's good. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the spirit would maybe go a little higher, or the fruit wouldn't be as clear and it went too floral, which happened this year. So again, I am confident that in 10 years that will mature out and it will come back to just being quite consistent. But we've marked those casks, so they go through extra sampling.
Two more questions.
Sure.
And maybe you can both expound on this. The what do you do with a really, really bad barrel?
Yeah. So
if something just didn't happen right, you know, there was a crack in the barrel and
sure.
plant matter grew into the cracks or something, like what do you do? Do you blend it off and into something and kind of, you know, put it into a massive batch to where it goes unnoticed, or you know,
yeah.
or like the designer cask too? The second part of that question is you've curated these intricately complicated and well meticulated barrels mm-hmm. to be used for Astar. And original. And if it, for whatever reason, if this was meant for, you know, long term for Astar or original or whatever, mm-hmm. if there's just something wrong with it, what do you do with those casks?
Yeah, so it really depends. There's a sliding scale on how bad you mean. So if it's slightly off what you expect, let's go through this.
Luck do bad.
Yeah. Well, no comments. Yes, yeah.
No comments. Media training.
Well, media training.
Yeah. I can say whatever I want.
Speaking of shite. No. So if it's a little off, that's actually the birth of some of our most amazing whiskies, because what you'll get at 10 years is we'll pull some samples and you'll have like a second fill cask that should have this bright citrus fruit, pears, apples, and a lot of honey. And then that kind of classic American oak flavor on it. Sometimes you get there, and even though it's 10 years old, it tastes a little young. It tastes like it's 7 years old or it's 6 years old. Mm-hmm. So that is a bad cask, but not really.
A stubborn cask,
so
for
that
sure.
One,
yeah.
Stubborn. So with that one, that's like a surefire one to lay down for another 8 years.
Right, you just wait it out.
Yeah, and that could well become part of like a beautiful batch of 18-year-old, because the balance becomes good
sure.
over time. Mm-hmm. If you have something that just doesn't come off the way you expected it to, so sometimes you'll buy very experimental casks, some very special sherries or some very different fortified wines, and we expect it to just come out so different. But after 2 years finishing in there, it just comes out tasting like La Santa, you know? Then that will either be blended away. A lot of times that will come into some special one-off batches, or it could maybe go into, give it another 6 or 7 years and it becomes part of Signet. The other thing is
big fan of Signet, by the way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, huge. It's so good. And the other one is if you have like a cask that is the main problem you get, and it's about 1 in 10,000 casks so it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But you might get a cask and it comes out smelling the same idea as when you get served a bottle of wine at dinner and they pour a little bit for you to check and it's corked.
Yeah.
You get that kind of damp cardboard, slightly musty aroma going on.
Sure,
in it.
Sure.
So first of all, our warehouseman knows every cask when it's empty. And that tends to pick up straight away, so we eliminate them. But let's say one in 10,000 will get through. The miracle of re-racking a cask is unbelievable. So it may have been 4 years in that cask and it's went a bit dull and a bit dusty. We'll simply take it out of that cask, destroy that cask, and transfer it into a brand new first fill cask or a brand new second fill cask. And it tends to brighten up, so it's sort of strayed off the course.
Sure.
But you correct time, it. Bring it comes back in.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll come back in perfect after 12 years. So guess what? Sometimes an original, you'll have some excellent whiskey that's 12 years old in there. Or, you know, there's 101 places that it could end up going. But re-racking is a really valuable thing. But the most important thing is we nose every single drop of our new make spirit. So there's not a drop in
new
make spirit.
So you know that you start off on a good step.
Get the spirit right and spend tens of millions of dollars, like we do, on the best cask you can possibly buy. If you do that, the likelihood is it's going to be good.
Right.
You know, so we
one
don't
plus
have to,
one is two.
Exactly. So we get offers for, we've got new supplier who've never worked with before, but they've got lots of sherry casks and it's a good price. So you're like, well, no, because that is just the
too,
risk.
Too much
is
of a risk
far
factor.
Too high. Yeah. And it's the money we never struggle to get. You know, we struggle to get money for certain things, like every other business in the world, but the money we ask for casks, it goes up every year.
Yeah.
And it's never questioned. It is signed off the quickest of any request for money in
our
business.
Well, I hope they don't hear that.
yeah, good point. But I think they realise just, I mean, the consistency of our spirit.
You don't want to hurt the brand.
You don't want to hurt the liquid. You know, the liquid, never even mind, you know, what that goes into. It's just the liquid is as consistent as it possibly can be. As consistent as you want a single malt to be. You want that natural variation that comes. But yeah, like I say, 1 in 10,000 casks, and I'm probably even being a bit rough on us. It's probably less.
Probably less, yeah.
And even those, in comparison to the tolerances in other parts of the industry, it's not an absolutely bad cask. And my only experience, and it was before I worked for the Glenmorangie Company, I did a stint with the Scottish Malt Whisky Society, nosing, and I spent about a year when I was in London nosing cask samples for potential bottling, society bottlings. And I had one
what
cask.
What a fun job.
Yeah, it was not a bad
job. The names for those bottlings are absolutely incredible.
You can blame me for a few of them at least. And there was, again this sliding scale of 1 to 10 in terms of the quality of the casks. And it had to be in the top three to get bottled by a society when I was there anyway. And there was only ever once a cask that was so bad that we actually sent a note back to the owner. We're not buying this, and we recommend that this is destroyed. And I think it was a sherry cask that had not had the sulfur cleaned out, and it was just
rotten.
It was like rotten eggs. The barrel
that can
was
happen.
So bad.
I mean, but more often than not, it's the liquid going in. So you can get caustic into liquid occasionally at certain distilleries, and I've smelt that before, and it's unbelievably unpleasant.
Yeah,
but I mean, we're so tight on it because Bill's obsessed with maturation and wood. And I'm going to leave that right there. but the other thing is, we only make single malt. So you have other distilleries that make single malt. Of course, there's single malt whiskey distilleries.
Some make rye.
But they'll be making 80%, they'll be making 80% of their single malt to go into the blending. So they can have a much bigger range of consistency. Everything we make, every drop of Glenmorangie goes into Glenmorangie. Every drop of Ardbeg goes into Ardbeg. So we have to be. We can't just take one that isn't quite our character and sell it and trade it. We only make our own stuff.
Yeah,
so
it's the same distillate across all expressions, right?
Same distillate across most Glenmorangie expressions. Signet, we do that mega. We just did it last month. So I was up at the distillery. We were up at the distillery. It's just unbelievable. I'll show you some pictures after this. I've got some video and stuff. The change when you use a little bit of high roast chocolate malt. But that's a day one innovation, as I call it. So it's 20 years later that the stuff me and David were helping to make last month will appear in Signet. But we've been doing that experiment for 20-odd years.
Yeah.
So that's different distillate. Everything else tends to be the same distillate with different casks. And for Ardbeg, almost all of it is the same distillate. Sometimes we'll do heavier peatings for supernovas and, you know.
And in terms of consistency, particularly with the two flagships that are original, Glenmorangie 10-year-old and Ardbeg 10-year-old, were actually held to kind of an even higher standard, and that both of those are certified OU kosher. So we actually have separate tanks. We can't actually make the original in the same tank as the extra matured range. It is completely separate. It's so completely that keeps separate. Us to a very, very high standard as well for the for those two originals.
It is quite a cool thing. The company built its own new bottling hall, and this is a bottling hall. You can, you'd expect it was a corporate headquarters. It's that beautifully done, and it's so clean and so hygienic. But we only have two single malts, so most businesses in the world would have went and found some capacity at the bottling halls that exist in Scotland already. But they were like, no, we want to be in control of this from
don't want to risk cross-contamination or any kind of... Because anytime you...
That's a hell of an expense, but...
Anytime you let go of, you know, take your hands off a certain part of the process, you're risking every everything.
But, yeah.
Is this our last segment? This kind of flown by. Yeah. Let me get a touch more of that nectar.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear what your favorite... I know yours is the 10, the original.
Yep.
What is your favorite expression?
I'm going to write it down.
You're going to guess what his is? Okay. Yeah, you know, all right, cover it up. Don't let him see it.
So my if you're asking what
By the way, he answered that immediately. He knew exactly.
If you're going to ask me what my favorite Glenmorangie is, it's actually the same answer I would give to the question, what's your favorite whiskey in the world? And I know I work for the company, so I'm kind of biased. But
so your favorite whiskey in the world is a whiskey that you rep?
Yes.
That's a good thing to have.
And you could accuse me of bias, and I do have a bias. The bias came in the other direction, though, because I decided when I was looking for a major company to work for when I was at the Scottish Malt Whiskey Society to write a list of distilleries that I would like to work for, from rank them most desirable.
Who are the top three?
Number one was the Glenmorangie Company.
Yeah.
I'll get to the second part of the question.
What's
later.
We're running
my favorite whiskey in the world is Glenmorangie 18-year-old.
That's what he said. Right
I just think that it's so.
What do
in
I win?
Keeping with the 10-year-old, in style,
just but a more,
it just
a little
has this
deeper,
honeyed
little,
note to it. It has this tropical fruit note in Glenmorangie 18 that
massively.
I just love it so much. And it makes me think of, I could actually sit on the beach and drink that almost. You know?
It's the 18 is, I said I started with Laphroaig 18. Uh-huh. That there's just something about, I know age statements are a consumer perception thing that a lot of people like to stick on, but there's just something about that, just that slightly older, slightly bumping proof with some expressions.
It's 18 is a good one for that because some people say I only drink a whiskey if it has an age on it, which is fine, but they're missing out on
good
stuff.
They're horrible.
It's fine.
They're stupid.
It's their choice, but they're missing out on some really, really good stuff.
And what
I'd say is, as well as you're missing out on stuff with non-age, there's been a real lean to some people saying, oh, age doesn't matter at all. And I'm like, whoa, that's also
that's
incorrect.
True.
That's really incorrect too. 18 is just one of those sweet spots where something special really happens, but it's the texture. It's that silkiness. It's that silky, creamy, beautiful softness that you get. You can only get that by waiting 18 years. You can't buy stronger casks or do a different range of ages.
Right, you can't cut corners. You can't. You can't
just wait 18 years and you get that beautiful silkiness that 18 has.
The thing with our 18 that really is why I like it so much is that it actually in many ways doesn't come across like an old, over-oaked whiskey. It's that perfect balance. You can still tell all those delicious floral fruity notes from the new make spirit 18 years before, most of that still shining through. If you look at most other distilleries, when you get to 18 and beyond, the distillery spirit character is largely swamped by the oak.
Yeah.
And with Glenmore 18, we've got this balance of just the right amount of a little touch of sherry in there, lovely American white oak influence, and then loads of that spirit-driven character still there.
Sure.
It's a genius move. It's just so good.
So what were the other two, the top three?
Top three companies, if I was to work for them. Diageo would have to be in there just for the breadth and depth of distilleries.
They're an interesting company for sure. They cover a little bit of everything. They're loved by some, hated by others, or even specifics of, I'm a huge Lagavulin fan.
If you're a brand ambassador working on their malt whiskey portfolio, you're like a kiddie in a candy store.
Yeah.
Everything.
Whatever you like, they've got something in there. Yeah.
After that, it would be a tougher call for me after that. I don't know. I'm trying to just think of distilleries that I really like. I love most Springbank. I could see myself repping Springbank any day of the week.
There's a they're not huge on marketing. Like I don't know the rep for Springbank here. But there is a an absolute cult following for them. I mean, there's a lot of people
who love
Spring Break. I mean, so I totally get it. Yeah, it would be a fun company for sure.
I mean, Mortlach from Diageo was the whiskey that really turned me on to single malt scotch.
Yeah.
So, and so different from Glenmorangie in style. But, you know, palates evolve. My palate has definitely evolved.
I think you chose the, you know, all things considered, I think you chose a pretty great company to work for.
It was top of the list.
So there's I'll say this, and then we've run out of time. But there's a woman locally who reps Glenfiddich and Balvenie that I work with quite a bit, Danielle.
Yeah.
And you know, in the age of the internet and people having an opinion about everything, it feels good to know that your brands are overall well loved.
Mm-hmm.
And has there ever been a controversy with Glenmorangie? I don't think I've ever heard anything. I mean, Ardbeg, you know, I know that when we switched to no age statements, there were some opinions when it became more common.
Yeah.
But
there was never really a switch for Ardbeg as well, which is quite funny. There was never a switch to non-age. It was just born. It was reborn in the 90s.
You added,
stop.
Right.
It started with non-age.
Yeah.
It's a funny one.
And in fact, if you go back to the very earliest records of Ardbeg and, I guess, Glenmorangie, they were both non-aged.
Yeah, at the original,
always good. But I guess Ardbeg's like kind of the exception that proves the rule with non-aged, because it's always started off as a non-aged whiskey, you know, except for the 10 or cheapest whiskey or most successful whiskey is the one that has the age statement.
Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. I mean, it's that young, that bright Ardbeg peatiness coming through.
Spirit-led. It's got a big, massive, raw, smoky.
Bright, because that's exactly it.
That's exactly what I think about when I taste
spirit-led.
It. You know?
Yeah. So we never got to Nectar d'Or.
I drink it already. I mean, we covered it earlier when you were talking about the Lasanta. You kind of went through and explained what the difference was between the Quinta Ruban. I keep wanting to think Quinta. The Quinta Ruban and the Nectar. You kind of explained it a little bit. Brandon, do we have like two more minutes to cover the – yeah. All right. Let's cover the Nectar d'Or because I haven't had it in a while. I had a bottle a few years back. And I remember thinking, okay, this is good single malt, but I kept pulling back to the Lasanta.
Sure.
And right now, I just asked for seconds on the door. So it's delicious.
Uh-huh.
So,
seconds on the door.
Yeah.
There's a line in there somewhere. It's got to be.
So talk to me about the door.
So this is our third finish, and actually, it has a link to Bacalta.
Oh, really?
So back before these. Extra matured whiskies. We had a sherry finish, we had a port finish, and we had a Madeira finish. So the Madeira finish Bill stopped making because he was finding some real inconsistencies in the casks that he was buying. So he was getting some that were super strong, some that were very light, some that were great, some that were frankly bad, some that were very loose and poor quality. So kind of with a heavy heart, he made the decision to stop making the Madeira wood finish.
Too much of a gamble.
It was just too much of some were coming out great, some were not quite what he wanted. Mm-hmm. He was having to put a hell of a lot of effort trying to hammer on the edges of these rough edges to get it into making this still much loved whiskey, mm-hmm. the Madeira, much missed. But what he hit upon is he started working on Glenmorangie Pride, which was one of our uber exclusive whiskies, and he used Chateau Yquem Sauternes casks. And that got him onto, that made an amazing, much older 28-year-old whiskey. But he realized that this Sauternes stuff was incredible. And he's a real wine nut as well, so he knew Sauternes. So he started working on something which eventually came out as Nectar d'Or. Sadly, he has absolute guaranteed quality now. But what he didn't quite appreciate is just how small Sauternes is. So we're really wanting about 1,800, 2,000, 2,200 barriques of Sauternes each year. And its bumper, its biggest ever year, Sauternes didn't fill 2,200 barriques. So we kind of created this amazing...
So even if you bought them all, you
don't have enough.
Don't have enough.
Yeah. So this is permanently available. It will always be on the shelf. It will always be available, but in very small amounts. This is also why it's a little more expensive. So this is the most expensive
cast. But it's barely. I mean, it's just such a... Less than $10 more expensive.
And these are the most expensive casts we buy. And we use them once for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So these are outrageously expensive casks, but it makes something outrageously good. two things are happening. The sauterne from the noble rot, in case anyone doesn't know. Noble rot is a fungus. It botrycizes the grapes. It kind of looks like the grapes have shriveled up and died, but they haven't. They've been dehydrated. So when you squeeze them, massively high sugar content in the grape must.
Really concentrated.
Yeah, yeah. Like syrupy. So when you add the yeast to that, the yeast turns like a tiny amount of it to a tiny amount of the sugar to alcohol, and then the yeast is done. The yeast cannot process it. So you end up with a wine that has a massive sugar content in it. So these residual sugars in the wine, after the Sauternes guys have matured it in the barriques, it comes to us and you have this wonderful stickiness inside these barriques. However, Nectar d'Or, if you start nosing it, it's 92 proof. That's one way we do it. But it's not just sugar. It does have beautiful kind of scraped vanilla pods, even vanilla ice cream. I get like vanilla ice cream with a wafer in it because it has that baked...
extra sweetness to
it. Yeah, that baked in a pastry, all butter pastry. But it's not just sweetness. And it's like all the fruits of Glenmorangie Original have been put in an oven and caramelised under heat. You know, caramelised peaches, tart au citron.
It's like a Danish pastry or something.
Yeah, yeah, just all these sweet things. But there's balance there as well. There's some white chocolate, but then there's white pepper. And you might even get something savoury, you know, roasting herbs. And that's because the barriques, which have this wonderfully sweet sauterne, they also are made of French oak. French oak's full of tannin. So tannin dries a whiskey. Tannin adds structure. And then tannin adds herbal notes, which is the worst word for a Scotsman to use in America. So we say herbal, but over here you guys say herbal. So I'm trying to say it adds lots of herbs, but we say herbs.
He does the American accent so well, it makes me think that he's constantly making fun of us. Like he's practiced a little bit.
It's actually just that I'm not actually from Scotland. It's just a shtick. But yeah, the tannins give it this wonderful balance. So with these two, with Quinta and Lysanta, it is a 10-year with a 2-year finish. But it can be 2.5 years, it can be 2 years, 10 months, it can creep up close to 3 years, and we're okay with that, we can keep it. This one is really tight. This one gets to 2 years, and we need it out that cask, because tannins very quickly
take
start
over.
That's the perfect way to put it. They really start to take over.
There's a... There have been many... I'm trying to find the right way to word this, and then...
Just go for it.
Many people use Sauternes. Yeah. And I've had it in a few single malts. And
there'll be one-offs, though. One-offs, single casks. No one does a permanent Sauternes but us, I don't think.
This, I'll write it down. There is...
Uh-huh.
Yep. Can you read that?
Yep. It's not a permanent.
It's not permanent?
Nope.
Okay. So, and it's not done as well. And I say that in a without
well, you know
what I mean is my perception of Sauternes has not been a very well liked one. I prefer a nice red wine or you know some Madeira. In fact, I was going to ask you about Amontillado because there was actually a phenomenal Lafroy that was done in 2014.
Yep,
other Amontillado cask, which was overwhelmingly well received.
Time to ask because we have Glenmorangie Teen, which is again our travel retail edition.
Yeah.
And it just won a big award. I was just about to say what award it was, and then I realized it's still under embargo. But,
but
Glenmorangie Teen is an Amontillado. It gets like nuttiness. It gets this nutty.
Is that
like marzipan?
Can that be found here?
If you go traveling.
Get out of here.
Traveling.
Or know somebody.
Or if you know somebody.
Yeah.
If you know somebody that
you
maybe
live in Dallas?
I do live in Dallas.
Okay.
Now,
we're going to talk more. Because I'll be there in about a month. We haven't taken a family vacation in years, but we're going up to there's a nice little Airbnb right in the hill country, just west of you guys.
Okay.
That I'll be stopping in Dallas because there's a lot of great. There's another couple of whiskey clubs up there.
Okay.
Yeah, so if let's talk Tane because I definitely, I was so overwhelmingly influenced. I loved it a lot. So I was hoping to find more outside the Lafroig Amontillado, but I haven't found one yet. So
sure. I'll drop in some of our competition. Diageo, one of their distillers editions, is an Amontillado.
Yeah.
Is it Kalila? No. It's either Kalila or it's Glenkinchie. One of them have an Amontillado finish. It's competition, but it's good. So check it out. Distillers Edition.
I can't tell you how many times we've had a brand rep in here who has overwhelmingly supported or talked about really good whiskey from the competition. So you're good in my book. Guys, thank you so much for coming. This was an absolute blast. We definitely went over. This was great. I wasn't expecting to
turn off the music. Turn off the music. I'm not finished.
I definitely want to talk more. If I had known that you were actually this close, we would have met up sooner. So I'm excited. Thank you guys so much, and cheers.
Cheers.
Yep. I always try to fit one of these in here. Yeah, there we go.